Welcome to the Success Coaching Podcast. On today's episode, our guest, Kevin Hoover, shares his own personal journey to success. Because success is a journey, not a destination. Here's the hosts of the Success Coaching Podcast, Todd Foster, Alyssa Stanley, and Kelly Scar.
Welcome back to the Success Coaching Podcast. My name is Alyssa Stanley, and as always, I'm co-hosting with Todd Foster and Kelly Scar. Today, we are humbled to have Kevin Hoover joining us from the infamous Hype RV, which is the command center for all things Kevin Hoover. Kevin is a real estate agent with eXp, founder of Hug Your People, creator of RIL Framework, which focuses on relationships, income, and legacy. He is an author and podcast host called Beyond Business, which focuses on business beyond the spreadsheet. Most importantly, he is a husband and father who has an incredibly inspirational story that began when his four-year-old son was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. Every parent's worst nightmare. From that moment on, their life was impacted. Yet they are currently on a mission to create positive impact in 1 million families every year across the world battling cancer. Kevin, we are so humbled to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much. It's quite an honor.
So I genuinely believe in my soul that every bad situation gives you the opportunity to create positive shifts in your life. Some do it, some leave it, and some won't see it. But your family's ability to shift and pivot in such a life-altering situation really resonates with me and my family, which is why I followed you for so long. Although we didn't face cancer, my family was rocked with having to really pick up with what once was and rebuild what will be. I would love for us to start this podcast with you sharing a little bit of the backstory of Hype and how it came to be.
I'd love to. And it really, the timeline is in question because when you're going through something like we went through, piecing together the facts is kind of tough. But luckily, through social media, we were able to share and kind of go back and kind of decide when it came up. So Hype is basically, it's our nonprofit. It's called Hug Your People. From the time of inception to now, we are now officially a 501c3, so officially recognized nonprofit with all the powers that be. But my son was diagnosed in 2019. He was a week before he was diagnosed, he was airlifted with total kidney failure and a tumor in his abdomen. So we went in for a normal checkup. If you're parents, you know, the kind of things, you know, tummy aches and things like that. And so we were just trying to get a sense of which medication we needed. There was no preparation, no mention of tumor or cancer up to that point. And we went in at 7 a.m. and by 11 a.m. we were, in the NICU with, all the doctors around us trying to learn what was going to happen next. So it was very much you're thrust into this environment that no one wants to be in. You're thrust into a club that no one wants to join, and you got to figure it out. And so looking back, you know, it was early on. Everything that we do has been the idea of my son. So the idea of Hug Your People came about. We're not sure when it came about. We do know that within 7 or 8 days of us being diagnosed, there was a post that said Hug Your People. And there was a graphic that said Hug Your People. And so it really just came very, very early on in the game, and we didn't know what it meant at that point. We didn't pursue it. It was just kind of this thing that we said. And then as we progressed with our treatment and things started working, it just became the thing. And I ask, you know, as we do as people in business, I ask social media, you know, if you think of me, what do you think of? And it was just this flood of Hug Your People. Everyone just said Hug Your People. And so it was really at that point that it became very intentional of a movement of inspiration, of hope, of my son kind of reaching across the digital lines and saying, hey, let me help you. Let me give you some motivation. So it started very early, and then it became more intentional as we went. And then today it's our legacy. It's something that will be the reason I was put here on earth. And that means a lot to me. It really does.
You're told, hey, by the way, your son or daughter or child has cancer.
Yeah.
When you're told that, what's the first thing you thought about?
There's been a mistake.
How long did you go through the denial period before you and your wife said, okay, you know what? This is real.
Well, oddly enough, our diagnosis came on April 1st of 2019, April Fool's Day. So we're sitting in a room full of tenured oncologists, nurses. And in my brain, I'm going, my dad really got me on this one. And this is too far. This is an April Fool's joke that has gone way over the line, you know. And so I'm still in that moment of this is not real. This is, we don't belong here. That's the thought that's going through your head. And then very quickly you realize that's not what it is. And we've got some serious choices to make. And we've got some serious education, an educational mountain to climb. To make, you know, my son was 4 at the time. He's 6 now. So you're making decisions for a 4-year-old. They can't make them themselves. And so you have to really learn. And so the denial period, it felt like it lasted a long time. From the time of me saying this is a big April Fool's joke to the time of us deciding on a protocol for treatment, I don't know how long. It was hours, not days. You know, and so it really lasted a very small amount of time because you don't have time to stay in that very long. Not because I chose it or I mindsetted myself out of it or I knew what to do. It's just you don't have a choice. You have to force yourself out of that and start making decisions and start doing things, you know, PET scans, MRIs, biopsies, you know, chemo, like what kind of chemo, clinical trials. Do you sign off on this? Like it's just this onslaught. And so the denial period lasted a very short amount of time because you just have to get into action. You have to do something. And so it forces you out of that.
How did you remain patient during that time? Because it seems like you have a test done and the results seem like they take years and years and years. So you're in pins and needles waiting for the results. So how did you keep your mindset in the right place, if you were able to at that time, waiting for test result after test result after test result?
I think the week between being airlifted and the week between official diagnosis was probably the longest of my life because you're battling the unknown. You just don't know. And so to say that there are no breakdowns in that week would be a lie. You know, there are dark moments. You're basically thrown into a tunnel. So every, you know, being a coach, being, you know, in real estate, you know, I'm used to kind of looking at the positive and I have the resources available to control my mindset, but I wasn't ready for this at all. This was a deep dive into, patience, controlling what you control, trying to stay positive in the darkest situation I've ever experienced in my life. You know, having the grace to be annoyed when someone says, just shake it off, or, you know, you should just go take a break. It's like, you don't get a break, you know? And so, it was really that week was probably the longest. And then, you know, after that, we went 70 weeks of treatment of roller coaster ride. So, we really exercise that muscle. I don't think there's a method to say, here's what I did and it works. I think it's moment by moment. You know, every day you wake up and you say, where am I today? How do I feel? You have to assess, you know, what's going on? You know, am I in the right spot mentally? Am I in the right spot? Am I focusing on the right things? And so it really was every single day reminding yourself that you've got a choice. And in my situation, it was how I showed up is how Baxley showed up, how my son showed up. So I had to really make that strong choice, even when I didn't feel like it. And that's something that really was, I think that's what built the muscle. You know, my perspective today and the things that I work around were definitely shaped by that 70 weeks of every day taking an assessment, making a choice, and then constantly doing that throughout the day. You know, because at any minute, someone walks in and drops a bomb on you.
I'm super interested to learn about how you take this experience and this mindset and, you know, put that into your coaching business, but before and how you can kind of coach your clients around this without obviously them having experienced what you've gone through. But before we get there, I'm curious about, you know, the 7 stages of grief. Did you feel like you ripped through those 7 stages over a very short period of time, but the battle kind of kept that away? And then at some point, once your son recovered, did those 7 stages kind of start to creep back in? And, you know, how were you able to deal with those?
I think I'm still dealing with them. I don't think it was a linear work through each step kind of thing. You know, it's such high intensity and it's emotional and it's practical and it's logical and it's, you know, it really is. And people are throwing their advice at you. And so it's basically you're standing in front of thousands of people and they're just throwing challenge after challenge after advice. So I don't think we worked through the 7 steps of grief linearly. I don't think it was move on to the next. Okay, there, that one's done. It was such a roller coaster depending on where we were. You know, I remember there was one time, you know, so when you have a child with cancer, you have to stay, you basically live in a bubble. Their immune system is 0. So they can't go to the movies. They can't go to school. They can't go to the store. Their immune system is zero. And so you have to be careful. And if my son got a 100.4 fever, we were in an ambulance. So you think about that's a low grade fever, something you and I wouldn't even blink an eye at. My son has to get an ambulance. So we're really looking at any moment that changes. So we didn't really, I don't think we had time to really process very much in the first few months. And then as we settle into treatment and it's working, but early on there was a situation where the hurricane was coming. We talked about hurricanes and a hurricane was coming. I lived on the coast in South Carolina. And so we have to be selective. You know, we lived at the time 10 minutes from the ocean. So basically sea level. This was definitely going to hit us. And it wasn't that the hurricane was coming. It was that my son can't be without power. If we're without power and roads are blocked and he gets a fever, what do we do? So we had to make decisions from a different place. So we chose to drive 2 hours inland, but we had to choose that. Is there a children's hospital there? Have our oncologists called their people? Do we have the prescriptions lined up? So it's that kind of fast pace, like every day it's boom, boom. So I don't think we really had a chance to process that until much later on. I think really when it really first started to hit me was probably when we got the first set of scans back and we determined that what we were doing was working. And I think that was the first exhale. That was the first. And that's probably when I went into the first feeling any kind of thing. You know, we were just so fast and furious, like keep going, keep going, keep going, you know, charge forward, make sure back is okay. And I think that was really the first kind. And then, you know, there's an alarming statistic between parents and PTSD. So parents that come out of something like this, suffering from PTSD from the experience. So we've been proactive on that. So I think that plays into the part of it as well. So I don't think there's a way. I think every person is different. I don't think anyone processes it the same or goes through it in the steps that you should go through it in a normal environment, because it's just not, I don't think it's just that. So, and we're still, the reason I say we're still going through it is because we're still triggered, you know, in the work we do, we have to be really careful and we have to take breaks. We're big picture. We're not that far out of it. You know, my son's about a year and a half, chemo free. So we feel good, but we can go back to that place very, very easily and quickly if we're not careful. So we're still processing. So that's a long answer to a short question.
Yeah, no, it's, I think it's a great answer. And I, you know, it seems to me like it's almost, there's no straight line with this, you know, mental recovery that you guys are going to be going through and, you know, obviously going through right now for, you know, the last couple of years. So I'm curious then to kind of circle back and go back to my, you know, my two part question there. The second part would be, you know, taking this mindset that you guys have been able to develop, you spoke about mindset a couple of different times during your son's story. I'm curious then how you're able to kind of take what you've learned and kind of adapt that and bring that into your coaching business with your coaching clients. Do you bring up your experiences often through your coaching and you know, bring some of that mindset and how you've been able to kind of navigate these waters? Is this something that that is prevalent inside of your coaching business, I guess, is the big question.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it restructured what I do as a coach. You know, so when we were diagnosed, I was coaching. I had a full roster of clients. I was also running my real estate business. So I had two, what I consider successful businesses for me going, you know, working 5, 6, 7 days a week, sometimes whatever needed. Wasn't shy about working late at night or early in the morning. And then, you know, like I mentioned, and all of a sudden the brakes just are thrown on everything, you know, so you have to really reassess your business. So I went from, you know, what a normal work week would look like. And through treatment, you know, we were in the hospital the first year, we were in the hospital 4 months out of the first year. So you're not in your normal environment. So the first thing, we were in the hospital the first week, the first thing I did, I was like, oh, well, I got to figure out how to coach from a pediatric cancer hospital. So I went to my good friend Amazon and I ordered a backpack full of stuff. I did a YouTube video on what went in that backpack. But, you know, so I ordered a backpack full of stuff that I would need to run my business from anywhere, because that was not something I was interested in before. I had an office in my house, you know, it had everything I needed. It was comfortable. And so then the next thing I did was look at my schedule, and I had to go from 5, 6 days to a day and a half. At first I had a day and a half that was allocated for work. So cramming a full course load, a full coaching workload into a day and a half, called all my clients personally. I said, here's what's going on. I will happy to refer you to another coach who may suit your style, or you can stay with me. It's going to be hard. I'm not going to be there 100%, but some days I'm going to challenge you on things, and just was very honest with them about where I was and what I was doing. So all of them stayed with me. Nobody left. And for the next 70 weeks, I coached from a park, from a car, from the chapel in the Ronald McDonald House, from, my son's hospital room, from the waiting room, from anywhere you can imagine. And so it was very much this professional communication of understanding. And I wasn't a bad coach during that time. If I wasn't feeling or my headspace wasn't there, I let them know and we rescheduled. I didn't compromise what they pay me to do. But through that, what I learned was that I was allocating a lot of time to do something that took a day and a half. And so I was allocating 5 or 6 days to do a really good job at something that I could have been doing in a day and a half or 2 days. And so I worked that for a long time. I'm a big proponent of, I don't coach something until I'm through it. So I was never going to coach about time management in this situation until I was through it and had it figured out and proved that I could do it. So I feel like after 2 or 3 years of doing that, I've kind of proven the model, so to speak, in my own business. So I really did that. And I just changed my life. And one of the things that I talk about all the time is the one thing that cancer took from me was time. And, you know, I'm trying not to get emotional, but it almost stole the only time that matters. Right. So the only time that really matters to me is time with my family. That's the time that you can't buy, you know? So how do I, but I still have bills. I still have desires. I still have aspirations. And one of the things they tell you when your kid's diagnosed with cancer, the social worker set us down on day one and said, "Hey, listen, one or both of you are going to have to quit your job." And I said, "Nope, not us." And so my wife at the time, she was with a company that really supported her. So I had to figure out the business part. I had to figure it out. Not only that, but how do I make a bigger impact? So our experience has played a huge part in my coaching. One of the things that I tell people now is that I will not coach you to be successful financially at the expense of your relationships, or at the expense of your kids or your time or your hobbies or your happiness, your mental health. So I don't think those two things, you don't have to sacrifice that even when you're building something, you know, your startup, you're building it, you're bootstrapping, you're hustling grind or whatever it is. You don't have to sacrifice date night because you're building something. And so I use those things that I learned just by being thrown into it all the time. It's not uncommon for me to prescribe to my clients to take a vacation or to leave the call immediately and take their spouse or partner out to lunch. Because that's what's most important. I learned that by time being stolen from me. You know, we're doing what we're doing now because that time, this is all the big picture. This is me giving 2 years back to my son. That's what it's for. He got 2 years taken from him. I'm trying to give it back. Am I doing it? I don't know. It's a lot of fun. We're having a good time and he's going on adventures he probably wouldn't do otherwise. So that's kind of what we do. So yeah, it definitely plays a part in it. And I think it's my responsibility to take my experience and learn from it and then see how I can impact other people with it. If someone else is, you know, not being a great parent or a great spouse or partner or a great friend because their priorities or their perspective is a little off, it's my job as a coach to say, let me show you a different side, you know? And so I think that's how I use it these days. The relationships, income, and legacy really are things that stayed on my mind for 50 of the 70 weeks, and I didn't know how to use them. And then I realized that I did. So the income is obviously an important part because I wasn't going to let cancer put us out of business. I wasn't going to let cancer bankrupt us. That wasn't an option. And I had to figure it out. You know, the relationship part was cancer will test your marriage in ways you have no idea. It'll test your parenting style. It'll test your frustration. It'll test the way you talk to yourself. So all of that became important. And then the legacy piece is where Hug Your People came in. When I'm gone, what are people going to say? Who's going to show up? And what trail did I leave? You know, did I leave a wake of profit or a wake of insanity? Or did I leave a wake of struggle? Or did I leave a wake of, he kind of helped me a little bit that one time, you know? And so that's really how this experience really shaped how I coach and what I do in business. And having done it now for a couple years beyond the inception of that, I have people that are having not only success in business, but their marriage is stronger and they're actually giving money to organizations they care about and they're impacting other people's lives. And that just means the world to me. That means that, that it can be done and we're trained that it can't, but it can.
You know, as I'm sitting here listening to you talk about your journey and your growth and how you and your wife and your marriage and your future came out better because of how you handled this situation, the strain that you guys went through on your marriage could have been detrimental. And there's people that I talk to who have extreme diagnoses and it obliterates their marriage. I'm very curious to know, how did you and your wife grow stronger through that rather than growing apart? Because the load that you guys were carrying individually was crumbling all on its own. And then you put it together. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. And I got to be honest. my wife's in the next room, so she would want me to be honest too. It was the most intense, difficult thing I've been through and still going through. You know, I believe marriage is a process and it's every day improves on the next. You know, we haven't got this figured out. You know, we were on a television show a couple of days ago, a week or so ago, and the gentleman said, you should put on marriage counseling classes. And I said, we should probably take a few. Right. So I don't think we're at the end of our journey. I think, you know, from the time that we started, it was just, we were going to do everything in our power to make sure it stayed together. We were going to make decisions together. We had arguments. We yelled. We said things we didn't mean. We did all the normal stuff that you do in relationships when you're going through high stress situations. We still do that. We do it a little more gracefully now than we used to, but we still do that, you know? And so I think one of the things that we tried to do is we tried to aim the anger at the right place. And we tried to aim the frustration at the right place. We tried to aim, and I think the biggest growth was we tried to aim the fact that I'm my own person, she's her own person, and we do things differently. We process differently. And I don't have to understand her way, and she doesn't have to understand my way. We just have to have a mutual respect. That took probably the longest for us to do because the questions were up. Why aren't you sad? Why are you smiling? Why don't you care? Why don't you, you know, these are all questions we ask each other in those moments, those high stress moments. So I think that was the big thing that came up. So I think we just committed to holding on. I think the hug your people when it came about and us taking our attention and focusing on helping other people, I think that mitigated a ton of the struggle. I think, you know, it was probably, I don't know, probably 8 months in where I realized that hug your people and us giving wagons to kids and doing things like that shifts our focus a little bit and eases our own personal frustration and anger and struggle. And by helping someone else, that's how you handle that. And it didn't make it go away. It meant that now I was in a better place to talk about it or communicate it or process it than I would have been had I not done that. So that was kind of, I wish I could tell you that it was intentional. We sat down and had a meeting and decided this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to tackle it. But in reality, things just kind of showed up for us that proved over time to be very beneficial. And we tried to just give each other grace and breaks. You know, we would alternate spending the night in the hospital so that no one burned out. You know, it was really just this, you know, teamwork effort like I've never experienced in a relationship. You know, it was really much, very much a team.
You've proven that you have a strong marriage because not only you went through that, then someone out of the two of you decided, hey, I have a great idea. Let's go and live in a travel trailer across the country with no personal space whatsoever. Since everything's going so well right now in life, whose idea was that in the first place?
100% my wife's idea. 100% my wife's idea.
And how did she sell you on this idea after you're thinking, holy cow, I've been through a lot, and now we're going to go live together in a travel trailer?
Well, you know, that's funny. You know, and Todd, I have to clarify with all due respect, it's a fifth wheel.
Oh, yes, a fifth wheel. Yes, my parents would also clarify that for me as well. Yes.
Now that I'm an official RVer, I have to clarify.
I don't even think I've ever heard anyone call it a travel trailer. Where'd you get that, Todd?
It exists. It's a thing.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a trailer that you travel in, yeah. Except his has a fifth wheel.
Exactly. So, my wife came up with the idea. And so it was originally her idea. It took zero time to convince me. I thought it was a wonderful idea. By that time, You know, my business was pretty much work from anywhere. We had kind of been locked in. We went from cancer to COVID. So we've been in the house for over 2 years at this point. And we were kind of looking to, you know, buy a new house and get, and, you know, give us a little more space because of that. And so she came up with the idea, and she'll tell you. And then almost immediately I went to Facebook and said, here's what we're doing. So now we have to do it. And so it was her idea, but I pushed us down the path very quickly. And I think it was probably within 2 or 3 months that we had sold the house and bought the camper and moved in full time.
Do you believe either of you could have thought about doing this to escape what you'd been through and start a new life together over?
No, I don't think we would have done that. I think had Hug Your People not been a part of the equation, it probably wouldn't be something we'd done. So the original pitch by my wife was, let's sell the house, buy a camper, and deliver wagons to all 50 states. That makes perfect sense to me. That sounds like something that we should do. That sounds like something that more people should try, right? If you have that window of time. So that's originally how it was presented. And that was the idea that we really fell in love with. It was taking Hug Your People on the road, meeting the kids, meeting the parents when we can, delivering wagons to all 50 states, building the network of awareness around pediatric cancer. And so the idea was really, that was the initial yes. The first yes that we had was that. And then as we started processing that, we were like, okay, well, we can do our own adventures. Okay, well, we need an office. Kevin's going to have to work and Sue's going to run the nonprofit. She's going to leave her job. So then all the logistics started to come in and everything just kind of made sense. And we were able to move very quickly on it. You know, it doesn't hurt that it's a great time to sell a house if you don't have to buy a new one. So that kind of made a little sense for us as well, financially. And so, I think the biggest question we had was neither one of us had ever been camping before. We'd never done this. I'd never backed a trailer. I'd never pulled a camper. I'd never driven a dually. We had an SUV, and a sedan. So we were those kind of people. And we're very much the go to the all-inclusive kind of family, as opposed to the let's build a campfire and sweep dirt off the rugs, you know, when we're doing that. So it was a brand new experience, but we embraced it. The RV community has been so kind to us and they see us coming from a mile away and have helped us out immensely. So that's kind of how that came to fruition.
Kevin, if any of our listeners have someone that could benefit from your wagons or want to get in touch with you, the website is hugyourpeople.org. Okay, hugyourpeople.org. And then you also have a Hug Your People podcast, correct?
We do. So the Hug Your People podcast started when we were in treatment. And I recorded that from the street, basically. I would record it mobily as we were being treated. So I think it started probably a few weeks after we were diagnosed. And I just wanted to document, it's all me, my feelings as a father, learning what I need to learn. So it's a very raw, real, you'll hear buses in the background. So it's not a produced thing. I would record it from the Ronald McDonald House to the hospital, or I would sit in the park and just share my thoughts and feelings, what we're going through. There was an episode where we had to fight a very, very large insurance company to get the information we needed for my son. And I had to go to bat and fight a very, very large company. And when I say fight, I mean, the CEO of my region called me. That's how high up I went. To get what we needed. And then, you know, the back end of that is they ended up playing that podcast episode where I talked about it in their training sessions, because it was just so. So the podcast, it recalls all of that experience that we went through, not just the it's the whole process of what a parent might go through with that kind of treatment. And it was very much, I did it when I felt like it and I was real about it. It wasn't edited at all. I hit record and talk for as long as I felt like talking and then publish it. That was that.
That's incredible. That's sorry to cut you off, but that is incredible that a multinational insurance company would take a recording that you made kind of off the cuff and on the fly and deploy that into their training. I think that speaks volumes about the leadership within that company, regardless of what you think of them. You know, the fact that they're willing to get better and make improvements, and man, the impact that you've made on hundreds, if not thousands, of other families' lives as a result of what you've just done is absolutely mind blowing.
I give that company all credit. You know, they could have very easily, you know, turned the other way or just said whatever. They could have very easily done that. The hard thing to do would be to acknowledge and to accept and to work and to lead around it. And they did just that. So I agree. I think it was the kind of thing where as a dad, I was angry. And you know, and to the credit of the CEO, he gave me his cell number and he said, if anything like this happens again, you call me first. And really what he was saying was, before you post it to your social network, you know, call me first. But I do give credit to that. I think if more companies took that in and of themselves and said, hey, even though it's negative, can we learn from it? You know, is there value in what's going through? Let's consider the situation. This is a father who's fighting cancer with his 5-year-old son at the time. What is he feeling? Why are our front lines of communication just checking boxes? And so I think that company did a great job. Has it had an impact on? I hope it has. I really hope it has. And I think if you heard that recording in their training session, I like to think that it helps a little bit.
If you're enjoying this episode, please rate, review, follow, and subscribe to the Success Coaching Podcast.
Logistics speaking, going across the country is a big ordeal in the first place, especially with anyone involved. So now you're driving a dually, which I know what that is, pulling a right. fifth wheel, not a travel trailer, and you're going from state to state handing wagons out. When you're handing these wagons out, do you have an idea of where you're going first, or do you go first and then search out the place to give the wagon out?
It's a culmination. So we are traveling to states. We're on our 12th state right now. But we're shipping out wagons all over the country. So we're not waiting for us to get there to deliver the wagon. We're shipping them as fast as we can, raising money, you know, trying to get as many wagons out there as needed. But we do want to personally connect with the families, you know, and what the sentiment. We delivered a wagon yesterday, my wife did, in Birmingham, Alabama, and meeting the family. And the dad told her, he said, you know, the wagon's great, but seeing Baxley, seeing where he is in his treatment just really gives us hope. And so while it's easy just to ship the thing out and be done with it, just like this time of year, especially, it's easy for a big company just to stroke a big check and say, there, we did good. I think it's really for us, it's becoming more and more important for us to actually connect with the families and let them see life after cancer. Let them see the chance that everything's going to be okay, even though there's a ton of different outcomes and different stories that they're facing. So for us, it really has become that. So the personal delivery is something we will probably always do. We find the kids when the kids find us. We let people know where we're coming. And we are always just, you know, whatever you believe, we're just put in the way of the people that need us the most. And that's been a really special thing for us to experience.
As you grow larger, do you foresee an issue of possibly having to say no to people? Or is your intention going to be able to help everyone that asks for help?
Our intention is to help anyone that wants a wagon. And so we will figure out the logistical piece. You know, I'm an entrepreneur and a business guy, so I will figure that piece out. We've already started doing current and encounter that. So we've started having ambassadors across the country where we will give them the information for the child. They will do the shopping and the delivery of the wagons and things like that. So as an extended arm for us, I think in September during Pediatric Cancer Awareness Month, we've got like 45 or 50 requests for wagons in a couple of days. So that's when we had to figure that out. So our job is not to say no. Our job is to figure out how to say yes.
If someone was interested in becoming an ambassador, how would they go about finding out more?
Go to our website. There's email on our website. You can get social media, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and just reach out and tell us what you're looking to do. And we'll kind of walk you through the process. It's very easy. And we guide you through it. It's not a lot going on. There's no financial outlay on your part as an ambassador. We collect the money. We're a 100% transparent company, meaning every dime that comes in goes back to the kids for now. There will be a point where that may not be the case, but right now that's how we're rolling, literally.
So one of your biggest goals that you talked about with everything that you're creating is a legacy. And again, I just sit here and listen to you and your wife's story in awe. And I think about, as a parent, the ultimate legacy you can create is that of your children. And in Braxley, you are creating a legacy that I don't even think at 6 years old. I mean, does he truly understand the impact that you and your family are making and that what his journey, how his journey is impacting others and how it's going to affect their future?
I think he's coming to terms with it. You know, it's funny. So we live in a 400 square foot camper. So we celebrated Christmas with my father during Thanksgiving because we're not going to be home for Christmas. So we made it very clear with the grandparents, hey, stuff is not what we need. We gift cards are great, you know, things like that. So my dad gave back a little jar of cash and he gave back like $250. And that's how much it costs to provide a wagon for a kid. You know, so in the wagon, we put a pillow, a toy, a blanket, some toys for the siblings. So, and then everything else that goes into it, it's about $250. So my dad gives Baxley this jar of $250 and we count the money and he goes, I can get a wagon. So I think he's slowly coming to terms with the good that's happening. We're kind of, as parents, we're kind of letting him choose whether he's a part of it or not. So if he doesn't, you know, feel like doing something, we don't really force it. You know, if there's a time, I hope there's a time where he wants to continue Hug Your People on his own and take it his way. But if he doesn't, that's his choice. You know, we want to create that option. But I think he really likes meeting the kids and playing with them and seeing them. His memory, because he was so young, is slowly starting to come back. And he's starting to recall those things, and it's starting to come up in little interesting moments as a parent that I wasn't really prepared for it to show up in. But it's a load of fun. I think right now he's embraced it. I don't think a 6-year-old can really grasp the impact that it makes for the family or the kids or the parents. I don't think that's possible just yet, but I think he knows that it does good. And that's really all I can ask of him right now.
So you're driving your dually.
Yeah.
You have your fifth wheel. It's your first time backing that bad boy up. How did that turn out for you?
It was a nightmare. It was an absolute disaster. So we had a set of standards. So I think with everything, you know, we'd never done this before. So we sold our house and we lived locally in our hometown for about 6 weeks. In that 6 weeks, we stayed at 3 different campgrounds and probably 6 or 7 different campsites. So we changed a lot, not necessarily by design, but we wanted to. And our standard was no pull-through sites. So you can't easily pull it in. We had to back this thing up as many times as possible before we set out on the road. So there was, I don't know if it was the first time, but one of the times we were having a lot of trouble. And so there were probably 5 or 7 employees of the campground out helping us. Probably all the neighbors had moved their cars. All the neighbors moved their cars far away, and they were out watching their stuff, making sure this circus didn't crash into their stuff. So we had everyone, and everyone's giving us advice. Suzanne's sitting on the picnic table with her head in her hands. You know, we had it, and I'm just in the driver's seat. Nothing's working. and of course I've got the dog and Baxley in the car in the truck with me. And so, you know, looking back in the moment, that was frustrating, but I know that was the moment where we learned the most, you know? And so, the backing, that was the part that was interesting. And then even today, you know, we've been doing this, we're about 5,000 miles into it, 12 states, probably, you know, 24, 25 campsites. And so even now, but because every campsite is different, you experience a different set of assessment and challenges, even though I know how to back the camper at this point. Right. So it's been a really great analogy of just when you think you got it, you go to someone's driveway in Michigan and he wants you to back up a hill into a driveway that barely fits you. And that's what he wants you to do. And, you know, so it's been a load of fun, but we do have a little confidence now in the backing up part. It's a great question.
How many wagons roughly have you delivered?
So far to date in total, from the time we started delivering wagons, we've just passed the 200 wagon mark. And we're about to cross the $100,000 mark in raised funds. We've just had incredible support from people. When we left, we were only at about 40 wagons when we left on August 1st. So we've delivered about 160 plus wagons in probably three and a half months. So a bulk of that came after our treatment, after we had decided, after we had kind of set this as our mission. And then a bulk of the money, we raised almost $40,000 in September alone. For our cause and the wagons. And so we've been fortunate enough to have incredible support from people who just feel like we're doing something good out here. And that's been remarkable to us to experience. I thought we would, you know, give away maybe 100 wagons the first year, and we've passed that in the first quarter, you know, so it's been amazing.
What do you attribute that to, Kevin? I mean, you know, it seems like you're utilizing certain media to kind of push the message and you know,
get the movement in front of as many eyeballs as you possibly can. Are you utilizing traditional media with a mixture of social media, or is it all social media? How are you driving donations?
Both traditional media and social media, primarily social media. You know, obviously it's free and everyone's tied into it, so everyone's already there. But we try to do some television spots everywhere in certain places that we go. You know, when we're back home, we always do a televised update with the morning shows there. You know, when we were in Michigan, we had some television crews come out to the camper and do that. We're about to do that again in Texas. So we do utilize traditional. I feel like that's a good way to share the story. Social media is the daily update kind of thing. But really what I think the secret sauce behind that is we started sharing our story pretty early on. And so before we were even raising money, people were part of our world and cheering us on and crying with us and laughing with us and doing all the things. So I feel like, you know, that in hindsight, that was probably the biggest thing that we could do to help push it along, is to just share the real, share the nitty gritty. You know, what are we going through? What is the real challenge we're facing? Share our stories with people we meet, you know? And so I think that really gets people more interested on social media. Right now we use Facebook heavily. We do YouTube, where we do a video recap of our trips and where we stop. We show of course, the montage of actually having all the fun and doing all the things. But we also, Susan and I, get on and talk about the milestones we're making, you know, our experiences and who we're meeting and things like that. So I think it's the mix that really gets people invested very quickly. You know, if you go back and you do a little research on Hug Your People, we've had so many people, because we've got our camper wrapped in Hug Your People logo. So many people say, I saw your camper, I went online, and they can consume the podcast, they can get the videos, they can tell Baxley's story. So there's definitely a digital trail of this story that kind of gives them reassurance that we're not just a family who decided to make a living off a nonprofit kind of thing. So there's a lot of proof, but because of that, they get really invested really quickly. You know, so I'll give you an example. We pulled up in Raleigh, North Carolina, to a state park. We were going to be there about a week. We pulled up. Some people around us were there for a family reunion. This was in the summer. They saw our camper, saw the logo. They went on Facebook. They started liking. They started doing all this stuff. And then the next night, they came to our camper with $1,300 and said, here, we want to help you. Right. And so I think without that story and without the mix of media and outreach, I don't know that people would have that strong of a tug. You know, I mean, that's a lot of money. And for us to at a state park to give us an envelope or, you know, donate $1,300, it's just remarkable. But I think I can look back now as a business person and go, oh, I know why that's happening now. It's because early on we shared that story. So I believe in the media mix, so to speak, of any chance you get to tell your story, take people up on it.
It's the resilience and the mindset, Kevin, that really amazes me about this entire situation. And so you experienced all this, and now you're going back into the battlegrounds where you once were, and you're seeing families under the stress and kiddos under treatment. How do you walk into a room, and there has to be a kiddo that reminds you of your own at that time, deliver the wagon, walk out? How do you decompress from that? Because you had talked about, you know, the aspect of some PTSD with diagnosis. That has to kind of jolt you back every now and then.
The darkest days of my life were in those treatment sessions. You know, some darker than others, some more easier to manage than others. But we're very careful of going back into that and being triggered or experiencing something. And unfortunately, for us to carry out what we've committed to, we have to learn to handle it on some level. You know, so it is very, you know, when we experience a family and their child has the same cancer as Bax had, or we experience, you know, even seeing the bald head, you know, my son lost his hair twice during treatment. Even that can be alarming. So you have to be really careful. You have to kind of prepare for what you're getting into. I have to put more faith in the good that we're doing than the struggles that I'm enduring. And I have to accept that responsibility. And I have to believe that I'm resilient enough to process that. And I am. I've proven it to myself, you know. And one of the things I talk about resilience all the time is that you never really know how resilient you are until you have to be. And I think you can train it, you can parent it, you can coach it, you can do all that, but you never really know how resilient you are until you really have to be. And I've just seen that time and time again in my life. And I'm sure, you know, you guys can relate on different but similar levels. And so I think when you really look at that, you have to ask yourself, what am I capable of? I use the analogy of taking a punch, right? Not actually, but metaphorically, you know, so I have to ask myself, am I willing to take a punch for that parent? Because I know I can, and I know they can't right now. Am I willing to do that to deliver 1% better for them today? And the answer is always yes, right? So that's just, I use questions for myself to really say, am I willing to do that? There are certain times where it takes me a little longer. You know, we're at the point of growth now where we're experiencing some devastating news from some kids that we've got given wagons to, the worst possible outcome you can imagine, you know? And we feel a connection to that. And so we have to allow time for that. We can't just charge forward like nothing happened. We have to really acknowledge it, allow time to process it. And I think that's the part of resilience that people ignore quite a bit. You know, resilience is not this just white knuckle your way through it, just force your way through it. You know, I don't think that's resilient at all. I think what resilience really is realizing how you process, knowing what the triggers are for you, knowing when something is a very quick mindset fix and when something's going to take a little time and allowing that time. And then moving forward, because that's just a better way to process it, you know. And each time is different for us. You know, there are certain days where, you know, I don't feel like delivering a wagon because I saw something or I read something or I heard a story or something happen, and I just don't feel like it, you know. And that's a conversation. That's a real conversation. It's not a, you know, buck up and go to work kind of thing. It's a real conversation. So I think, you know, when you talk about resilience and mindset, I think the part that I'm really pushing, and I think I hope more people are, is that it's not just get through it. It's not how fast you can muscle your way through this thing, right? Resilience is being so self-aware in the moment that you make the right decisions for moving through it at a pace that serves you and a pace that serves the people you love. You know, you guys know as well as I do that if I just pushed through and just ignored everything that was coming to me, what's going to happen? It's going to come out in my marriage, in my parenting style, in my coaching, in my friendships, in myself, you know, so it's going to come out. There's a really great song I was just reminded of when I said that by Travis Meadows called Sideways. And the whole catch of the song is if you push it down, it's going to come out sideways. And he's talking about that exactly idea. If you push that trigger down or that emotion down, it's going to come out, and it's probably going to come out in a way that you don't want, right? So I think that's really been the thing that we're very aware of now. Our self-awareness has just gone through the roof when it comes to that. We respect decisions. We still have to do the things we have to do. And I'll say that, you know, most times when we deliver a wagon, it's an absolute joy. And there's no problem. There's no trigger. It is an absolute something we look forward to all week. It is an absolute joy. It's something we say we get to do. It is just that. It brings us, it's the highlight of our week. You know, if you watch any of the YouTube videos, there's a lot of fun stuff going on. The highlight of the week is still delivering the wagon, right? And so I think that's what I need to also express, that it's not this, I have to talk myself into it or force myself to do it. I deal with what I have to deal with, but for the most part, I'm excited for my family to be able to do that for another family.
So prior to all of that, prior to this, you know, hyper self-awareness, there had to have been a time where there was extreme anger and this idea of this is being done to us. You know, when somebody, we're being punished for this, that, or the other thing. I'm interested in your response to this because I just experienced something here the other day that was very, not even remotely close to what you're going through. But I found myself just having to sit back and remember that the situation that I was in was not about me. I had to remove the I, right? And I had to focus on the person that was in front of me and ensure that I wasn't bringing my selfish attitude into that conversation. Now, I'm not saying that your scenario is selfish in any way, but I'm curious how you moved out of this modality where you feel like this is being done to you, and you know you had to step up and lead your family out of this darkness. How did you shift your mindset and getting away from that and coming to this realization that it if like without you operating as a unit, that you probably all wouldn't survive this at some point?
It's a great question. Kelly, one of the first things I tell people, you know, because I do hear it a lot, I talk to people a lot, as you'd imagine. I don't think my situation is worse than yours, regardless. Is cancer worse than situations? Yes. But you and I, you know, person to person, I think we all have struggles that we go through, and that doesn't make one better or worse than the other. But one of the things, there are three moments, really. One of them lasted a long time. The day that I put my son and my wife on a helicopter with a tumor and kidney failure, and I had a 2-hour drive ahead of me, I went home to pack a bag for my wife. And my mom had made a little step stool for my son that he could stand on to watch me cook and to eat his snacks and do all that stuff. So I go back home without my son, without my wife. They're on a helicopter going to ICU, 2 hours away. And so I touched that stool and collapsed, physically collapsed in my kitchen. A physical response to struggle. It was the first time in my life I'd ever experienced that. And I don't, you know, I don't know if I went unconscious. I don't know what, how long I just remember that when I got my wits about me and I came the next moment, I remember, there was one central thought, and it was like, not today. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what we were facing, but it was just that thought of not today. And over time, you know, so in that moment, it meant this is not how it ends, you know. Over time, what that meant was, instead of directing all my anger at something I don't control, cancer, I don't control cancer, I don't control the treatment of cancer, right? Instead of directing all my anger at that, what can I direct that would be positive, that might actually help? You know, the anger came from trying to control something I will never be able to control, right? And so I noticed those emotions coming up at an incredible rate. When I was getting the most angry, it's when I was really trying to control the outcome, of which I never was going to be able to, right? And so I find that just kind of permeated everything that we did at that point. And once I let go of control and just started asking myself, what do I control? I control how I show up in this moment. I don't control whether that works. I control what we do next, right? I don't control whether I don't feel like doing it, because I have to do it because it's that kind of thing. And so it really was that I started using that in other areas of my life. What do I control? And I found that that was the first moment. The second moment, we had to, without getting too graphic, we had to catheter my son for a few weeks, 5 or 6 times a day. My wife and I, I'm not a nurse. I'm not a doctor, not even close. And I've got the college transcripts to prove that I'm not a doctor, right? So we had to catheter my son 5 or 6 times a day for a while there to be able to come home from the hospital, because that was his only way of his kidneys to function properly. And so our life for probably, I don't know, it felt like an eternity, but it was probably like 2 or 3 weeks. Our life every day was finish this task and spend the next 3 hours dreading that task again. Because it took 3 adults to do it. You know, keep in mind, he's 4. Didn't want that done. And so it very much was doing something you don't want to do for the greater good. Without doing that as a dad, without learning how to do that, we don't get to stay home. We have to go back to the hospital, and he still has to have that done. And so that was really, you know, the part where the anger really started to come in at an alarming rate. It really started to come in of, you know, there's got to be another way. You know, or why us, or this is not fair. And look at all them out there enjoying their lives, and we got to do this. Look at them at the restaurant, and we got to do this. You know, all of those thoughts were flooding in those few weeks. And then I started asking a different question and started not comparing myself to, or comparing our family to, people out there doing normal things, quote unquote, but really saying, am I willing to do this for my son? So it is that little tiny shift of, instead of looking out in the world and saying, look at them doing the normal stuff and they're not going through this and how lucky they are, I started going inside myself and doing the heavy lifting there and saying, am I willing to endure this for my son? I think any parent's going to be like, yes, I am, in that situation, you know? So it became less about poor me and more about I'm willing and I choose, you know? I don't choose that I have to do it. I choose how I do it. and I choose how I feel about it, and I choose how my son feels about it. So that was really that. And then there was one final time where I just went in the bathroom at 3 a.m. in the pediatric oncology hospital room and just sat on the floor and cried. And just cried at 3 a.m. Allowed it. I didn't fight it. I didn't say I shouldn't be doing this. Just sat there and did it and woke up the next day and carried on and did what I needed to do. So I think those moments of emotional purge are very important, of not keeping things under wraps, having your support system, having the person you talk to, but also saying, if I just need to do that, you know, and you take that moment was so important because I've not, you know, I do some public speaking. So I've been on stage in front of a lot of people and crying and not apologizing for it. That's the key. Not apologizing, not saying I'm sorry for being emotional. You know, I think that's super important. So in a way, it liberated me from all that. So there's no real one answer of how do you keep the anger and how do you keep the emotional stuff. I think it really is a combination of everything. It's a compound effect. For me, it was those three moments. Looking back again, in the moment, I didn't know the significance. Looking back, those three experiences really shaped the way that I can handle things today and the way that I process triggers as I move forward. Really did.
As a business owner, you have talked about growing the business, and this is somewhat a business. Do you have plans for your Hug Your People charitable organization to become something that's mainstream, such as possibly partnering with the Ronald McDonald House or hospitals or healthcare providers?
Yeah, we want it to be as big as possible. Our goal is to give away $1 million a year through Hug Your People. Through that, we need strategic partners. We need leverage. We need all the things that, you know, business folks should need. You know, I think that's kind of how we're approaching it. You know, we're not quite sure how to do that yet, but we're figuring it out. And so we are reaching out for, you know, corporate partners, you know, be it through the wagon sponsorship, through corporate donations, through, you know, camping, trucks, everything. So we're definitely seeking that because that's just a way to make a bigger impact in a smaller amount of time.
The lightning round.
All right, Kevin, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. What is your favorite cake flavor?
Chocolate.
Oh, there you go. I like that. Yeah, that's a good one. That's perfect. What is your favorite hobby?
My favorite hobby is playing guitar.
There you go. I guess you get to do a lot of that sitting around the campfire, right?
It seems like you would. Not as much as you might think. It's a lot of work keeping on the road, but I was a musician in a former life, and I just try to, it's a relaxing thing for me to do to kind of decompress.
What advice would you give your young self, so that 20-year-old Kevin?
Oh, my goodness. 20-year-old me. Whew, I wish you could have met him. What advice would I give my 20-year-old self? I would say make things matter. And what I mean by that is believe you have time, but don't believe you have infinite time. Lean into what you're interested in and passionate about and like doing sooner.
Great answer. What is your favorite season?
Fall. No, spring. Sorry. No, summer. No. Definitely fall.
That's a good. Oh, there you go. All right. Last question. What is your favorite number and why?
17. My favorite number, 17, is because that was my number in high school in soccer. And for me, that jogs the memory of the closest that I can remember feeling to that many people, meaning being on a team, having success, contributing, feeling like I contributed, having accolades. It was just the perfect storm of everything we want as people. And so it always reminds me of that time of being part of a very successful group of people who liked each other, who worked together, who tried hard, who really prepared, and then went on to do their own thing. So 17 is my number, and that's why.
That's a great answer to that question. I thought maybe it was because Devontae Adams is your favorite football player of all time, and you're a huge Green Bay Packers fan. But I could be wrong.
Definitely not.
Totally understand if this is a no, but I thought it'd be kind of a cool ending if Bax joined you. Would that be possible?
Yeah, let me see.
That's all right.
Yeah. Hey, Bax, come here for a minute. You want to get on camera real quick? Now the dog's coming. Everybody's coming. The whole family.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Can you say hello?
Hi.
Hey, Baxley.
Hey, Bax.
Hi, Bax.
Can you tell them how old you are?
I'm 6.
Wow.
What are we doing in the camp?
Wagons.
Do you love living in an RV?
Yes.
What's your favorite part about your RV?
There's so many. It's 400 square feet. There's so many favorite parts.
Yeah.
So he has a little bunk above my office that he sleeps in. He's got a little TV up there, and that's kind of his space. And so that's kind of his gaming zone and favorite area.
That's awesome.
The dog sleeps up there with him at night.
Do you lock your dad out so he doesn't mess with your games?
He doesn't have to. Dad's way too big to get up in that loft. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Success Coaching Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow or subscribe to the Success Coaching Podcast at your favorite podcast provider. For special access to past recordings, videos of past episodes, and more, please become a Success Coaching Podcast companion at successcoachingpodcast.com.